CTSNet friends, welcome to another edition of the CTSNet Beat. We have a packed edition, as always. We've got three great papers, including one really massive paper, just absolutely slam-dunking the need for people to do concomitant AF surgery when they have patients in AF having CABG. There is a great patient story from an amazing account of a patient from New NYU Langone, and a DVT or PE incidence paper on lung resections. We have also three really good videos, and again we've got a wonderful video from Ralph Damiano, a guy I absolutely love, so it's really great. Do tune in for that. We've got an easy technique for diaphragm plication, and we provided a summary for you of all of the best content that we've got for you from April, so do check that out. And do stay tuned for the full edition of the CTSNet Beat. Thank you so much for joining me in the CTSNet Beat. I am reviewing all the exciting news and information around the world in cardiothoracic surgery, so you don't have to. So you can go and have a run, you can drive to work, you can chill out and feel cleverer, I hope, after listening to what we have to say. And in my full flow discussion today, I thought I would use the topic of atrial fibrillation surgery. Now I'm doing this because we are profiling a really important big paper from the Annals of Thoracic Surgery this week, and also I did a wonderful interview with Ralph Damiano. I absolutely love Ralph Damiano. Actually, when I started doing videos for CTSNet, it was all the way back in 2011, we decided that I would do a video interview series, and I was going to call it The Giants, and it was really exciting. It was really fun because basically a little tiny minnow like me got to talk to all these amazing people. And one of the first three people I chose to interview was Ralph Damiano, because I was fascinated actually by exactly every single detail about surgery for atrial fibrillation. I was keen and new into practice, and it just made a lot of sense to me. Let's get these people out of atrial fibrillation. And he gave me such an eloquent demonstration back in 2011. Feel free to go back and check the videos of one of our first three giants, he looks just the same. I may look slightly younger and slightly older now, but he looks just the same, I'm sure. And he gave such a great, eloquent demonstration of exactly all the steps. And he said down there, hardly anyone was doing it 10 years ago. And so I met up with him again in the STS this last year in San Antonio, and we had a discussion. And really, he kind of told me that really we're about 50% of people having surgery if they come to the operating room with atrial fibrillation. And so it got me thinking, you know, is basically 1% or 2% 10 years ago to maybe 50% at the moment for everybody coming to theatre in atrial fibrillation, having concomitant surgery, is that good or is that bad? So on one hand, I'll maybe tell you in a minute about what I feel the evidence is. I mean, I think it's absolutely slam dunk massive. So in one sense, why aren't 100% of people doing it? But then on the other hand, you know, we have got there. And I got to thinking about how we evolve in cardiac surgery and all specialties of surgery, really. And some issues go really fast. So in the UK, for example, at the moment, we are absolutely clattering our way to becoming the world's first fully robotic thoracic country. And why are we taking up the technology probably vastly in advance of the evidence? I mean, absolutely advance the evidence. There's no evidence really that it's massively better than VATS. And yet we're all taking it up. Whereas AF surgery, you know, we've taken 10 years to get to 50%. And I think the answer lies somewhere in just your gut feeling as a surgeon. You know, when you sit down on a robot, you love it, so you go for it straight away. When you're thinking about doing a lemur to the LAD versus a vein, well, of course, nobody would do a vein unless they're really very unwell. So there are things to us that just make instant sense, and they get adopted super quick. Then there are things like atrial fibrillation that your first gut feeling is, 20 minutes. You know, I'm so good at doing a CABG, or I'm so good at doing a mitral repair. Why would I want to upset the apple cart and sort of add 20 minutes to it, you never know, maybe it causes a bit of extra sort of hassle or a bit of trouble for the patient. So there's a group of things that we try and implement that maybe aren't of obvious benefit to us as surgeons. And I think maybe atrial fibrillation might be one of those. And in thoracic surgery, maybe it's an extensive lymph node dissection that isn't immediately obvious to people. So how do we then affect change? Well, the answer is probably what has been done so well in atrial fibrillation surgery recently, the evidence. So there is now a wonderful STS guideline out all about 1A evidence for you must, which they actually have to say, you must do atrial fibrillation concomitant surgery if someone comes to you with CABG. You must do AF surgery if you're doing a mitral, if they're in atrial fibrillation. And why have they done the you must? Well, because there's multiple randomized trials in the benefit. And this is survival benefit. You know, sometimes people get 20%, 5 or 10 year survival benefit for being in sinus rhythm versus atrial fibrillation. They have lower stroke risk. They have better function. So, you know, it's a real slam dunker. Now, I've written quite a few guidelines in my time. Just had another one on pectus accepted last week by the European Journal. Thank you very much. Nice guys. Probably profile that one day. But I actually step back a bit and say, well, guidelines often can be useless. I've done plenty of guidelines to which I think they've made no difference whatsoever to our clinical practice. So this wonderful guideline we've got in atrial fibrillation from the STS is not enough. I think it's not enough. I think we're not going to get from the 50% of people having concomitant surgery to 100% just by a guideline. You know, you write it, it's published, May edition, and all's great. Thanks very much. Didn't read it. Disappears. So what actually makes change is to think of the mindset of the surgeon. You know, what is going to make a surgeon get out your bipolar ablation device, get your cryo device, go and do your lines, maybe learn how to do the right side ablation lines as well as the left side ablation lines. Do things maybe you haven't been taught in your training. And the answer is being rewarded for it. Now, that I'm not saying money. I'm just saying being rewarded perhaps through being at a best practice award, having a committee or having a society saying that you have an outstanding practice in heart surgery because you do adhere to this guideline, saying that you're a 5-star rated practice, saying really great things about what you're doing. So I think actually, and these are coming, certainly I think America are well ahead of the rest of the world in this, is actually giving best practice approval to centres to try and effect best practice change. And I think that is where it's going to come. Also, the other thing is if you've got best practice, you know, maybe publish these less important outcome factors. Now, I know that's a really dirty word these days. Publishing people's mortality certainly has been super painful for us in the UK. But actually, in thoracic surgery, we're very successfully publishing some less important data that the media don't care about. And this is one of the great examples. If we published the surgical AF treatment rate of those in AF going on for CABG or mitrals or aortic valves as well, then, you know, it will just drive change because me as a surgeon, I'm going to look at that league table and go, oh, painful. I can't believe I'm a bit low down in the table. I need to push for change. And so best practice reward, maybe publication of best practice, what's it like? We actually have something in the UK called Getting It Right First Time, where this really big document is published based on NHS data. And it's in about 20 or 30 fields. And it just shows you what you're like compared to other people in the country. It's not actually published around the place very much. So mostly it's just surgeons seeing it. And yet you really get to see what others are doing that you're not. And we've got like 3 or 4 cringe moments where we're like, oh, we better try harder at this or that. And, you know, it's just us doing it. And I think maybe AF surgery could be one of those. And then as Ralph Damiano very correctly says in his wonderful video that we're profiling this week, there's a little training piece. You know, let's just help and support people, because, you know, it might be the elephant in the room. It might be the, instead of a surgeon saying, oh, I don't want to do that, I don't believe the evidence, the 1A evidence that's published in a guideline, they might actually just be saying, oh, I never actually got taught this. You know, I don't actually know where the lesion lines go. I don't know whether I can leave out the right-sided lines, just do a box lesion and get out and close the appendage. You know, and actually sitting next to a really great AF surgeon and getting those little bits of hints and tips might just be the thing that gets them over the line. And my final conclusion about the surgical treatment of AF is actually my glass is half full, not half empty. If we've gone from 1%, maybe 20, 15 years ago, to 50%, then that's not so much slower than a drug. Pembrolizumab took a decade to come to clinical practice, and yet it's absolutely a earth-shattering, wonderful drug that's saving lives every day, because it did its stage 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials. It went through endless committees before it went mainstream. And maybe it's not such a bad thing that we spend 10 years trialing and testing and proving and doing all the trials. You know, it probably isn't the right thing to do to have everybody doing something just because of one RCT or even two. Maybe we should accept that in surgery, occasionally, we should go at the same rate of medicines and be really careful and really thoughtful. And then the power of the evidence will eventually mean we all do AF surgery concomitantly when needed. So let me know what you think. Do you think we've gone too slow? Do you think we've gone too quick? And actually, we'll try and maybe post a few sort of how to do it videos of AF surgery, because I think that is a real valuable extra, because it's actually just where the lines go. It's not like a super technical skill. It's like if you've seen it a few times, I think that's where people can progress. So just moving on to the three papers we are profiling, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that AF paper that got me thinking about this subject. The title of it is Concomitant Treatment of Atrial Fibrillation in Isolated CABG. Its lead author is the wonderful Vinay Badwa. It's got Scott Rankin, many others, and from the wonderful West Virginia Department of Cardiovascular and Thoracic Surgery. And they got one of the fabulous databases that are so good in America, the US Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Inpatient Claims Database. And they looked and identified all patients with AF who underwent isolated CABG. And it was 2018 to 2020. So I would say that's a pretty recent set of patients. So this is not a historical trial. And they had a look to see what happened. This was 19,000 patients, so absolutely massive. And they stratified them between people that had ablation and ablation and appendage occlusion, because I haven't said anything about appendage occlusion, and Ralph Damiano in his interview with me talks a lot about the wonderful Laos trial. I mean, literally, you couldn't have a more slam dunk brilliant trial than that. We were part of that in our unit as well, and really the results were fantastic, and what a well performed trial. So this study stratifies surgical ablation with appendage ablation, appendage occlusion only and no treatment. Interestingly, the no treatment group, 58%. So actually, we're not even at half in this group of CABG patients. We had 17% having ablation and appendage occlusion, and 23% had appendage occlusion only. So interestingly, people are happier to occlude an appendage than do the AF lines, which I guess if I had to think what the reason for that is, maybe it's time and safety. And as Ralph says very eloquently, there is no adverse mortality with surgical AF ablation. In fact, there is an advantage to it in many of the studies, of which there are multiple in a randomized fashion. So I think just because it's easy, people are adopting appendage occlusion quicker. There's really nice devices out there for closing the appendage with a quick clip, which is really nice. Or you can use something called a suture, which which is even easier as long as you do a TOE to make sure you've got it closed all the way to the base. So what did they find? Well, they found slam dunk, massive benefits. So there was a significant reduction in readmission for stroke at 3 years, a hazard ratio of 0.7. So you're talking like 30% less people coming in for stroke and a big significant p-value. And if you did the full WAC ablation appendage occlusion, you had improved survival with, again, a really good hazard ratio, 0.86, a 1 in 100 chance that that was got by luck. So really, really good. You are saving the life of your patient by doing this, like literally. So really good outcomes for that. And they obviously conclude that if you're coming with persistent or paroxysmal AF, or longstanding, you should have this treatment. So great job, guys, from the University of Virginia. So moving subjects, we thought we would take a little light look at something just in the news. We're going to maybe have a little look at a few just mainstream news items just to bring them to you, because sometimes I don't see what the public are seeing. And one thing that caught our eye was a paper in ABC News about a 56-year-old lady who is the first woman to undergo combined LVAD implantation and a genetically modified pig kidney transplant. Never happened before. And this was all stimulated by a press release by NYU Langone in New York on April the 11th, because this lady was really ill. She's 54 years old, Lisa Pisano. She had young children, and had really bad heart failure and had a kidney failure, was on a dialysis machine. So she was not eligible for heart transplantation due to her kidneys, and because she'd had loads of antibodies, they thought that they were never going to get a match for her. So therefore they created a gene-edited pig organ. But in order to put that in, she had too bad heart function, so she wasn't eligible. So NYU Langone first of all gave her an LVAD, and then a month later she had a gene-edited pig kidney. So obviously we've had a few of these pig organs in cardiac surgery as well, and they're still in evolution, aren't they? But this seems to have gone very well. She's doing really well. She's at home with her kiddies and doing great. So congratulations. Really, really good. Probably that will happen more. And I think it's fabulous news to see a gene-edited pig organ being a success. Interestingly, if you look at the article, they only did one gene edit. It's not like they're editing thousands and gazillions of bits of the genome. They only knocked out one thing to make it rejection proof, which I was really impressed with, which means probably that will be a bit easier in the future. Our third paper also is a paper that is on predictors of venous thromboembolism after lung cancer resection. You know, sometimes these papers are sort of, oh, is that all? I'm so bored by PEs and DVTs. But I like to profile these because actually it reminds us that this is a very serious issue and a serious problem in cardiac and thoracic. And this was a thoracic paper. This was by Michael Lanuti, Mass General Hospital. Yolanda Coulson's on the paper, big paper, Annals of Thoracic Surgery, 57,000 people, another huge paper. And when they looked at their database, 1.3% or 758 people had a PE after thoracic surgery. That's pretty sobering. I'm currently giving our patients a 0.3 chance of mortality based on our own data undergoing thoracic surgery. So you're three times more likely in my practice to have a PE. And so that's 1 in 100. So that's quite a lot, really. It sort of highlights to us that actually that is, you know, the current boundaries that we need to be minimizing. They look at who gets PEs, and obviously the bigger the operation you have, by lobectomy, pneumonectomy, the more likely you are to have a PE. The iller you are, so interstitial fibrosis, extent of resection, longer operation, you're more likely. Interestingly, black race is associated with a higher chance. And if you have a PE, you're 14% likely not to make it versus 3% in this database. Very good to see minimally invasive surgery reduces your chance of PE. So just a nice little paper to remind us to be very diligent with your DVT prophylaxis. Make sure we actually send people at home injecting themselves, which I never used to think was that important, but this does highlight it is. The patients hate doing it. They hate having their stockings on. But I think if we do quote them these numbers, I think they will understand its importance to protect that 1 in 70 chance of having a PE. So those are all our papers, and I will just hand you over to the CTSNet office for a word from our sponsors this week.
When it comes to treating the most serious types of atrial fibrillation, persistent and long-standing persistent AF, and relieving pain after surgery, AtriCure is your partner of choice. With innovative technologies in open ablation, minimally invasive ablation, left atrial appendage exclusion, and postoperative pain management, AtriCure is counted on by electrophysiologists and cardiothoracic surgeons around the globe who are seeking treatment options for patients who suffer from AF, have a high risk of stroke, or suffer from postoperative pain.
Thank you very much for that message. So we got three great videos for you this week, and I have honked on endlessly, haven't I, about the first one, which is my lovely chat with the wonderful Ralph Damiano. He's actually got loads of other interviews out there on YouTube, so do check him out. And it is a pleasure, as always, to talk to him. And he really did talk about the level 1A evidence for atrial fibrillation surgery, about what we need to do and how to stimulate this in our community. But I think we did conclude, our glass is half full, things are getting there, the weight of evidence is huge. We just need to highlight and shine a light on best practice. And I think Ralph has done an absolutely wonderful job in his illustrious and fantastic career to be just this major baton carrier, because he learned from Jim Cox and he has carried that on very admirably into this next generation as we try and do absolutely everything that's good for our patients. The second video we've got is a thoracic video, and this was from Insilins and a team that just showed us a very simple, low-tech way to do a diaphragm plication. Basically, they just did a uniportal, no CO2, piece of stitch, needle holder, and just give it a good old stitch. It's beautifully filmed. It shows the diaphragm above the inferior pulmonary ligament. It shows them suturing from right next to the ligament, from furthest away from the camera, using a knot pusher, doing horizontal mattress stitches with buttress mattress pledgets, and then stitching towards yourself. And at the end, you can see an absolutely perfect job of the diaphragm, super, super tight, stretched nicely, way, way below the diaphragm, below the pulmonary ligament, and a nice job was done. Really, really cheap, low tech, which was great. So that was really great. I love doing diaphragm applications, done 141 in fact, and I personally love using CO2 so that I can get that diaphragm pushed down really, really nicely. That's my personal little tip. I actually use an endo stitch as well, which is really good at stitching, and that just means that I can use a 10mm port and 2 5mm ports for doing this. But whatever you do, it's not the world's most common operation, so I actually learned it on a VATS YouTube video. So actually have a look at this if you're interested in diaphragm applications, and have a look out there for a few videos and choose your favorite style. But well done this group for a really, really very cheap way of doing a very good job. My only other little tip is they use 2-0, and I have stopped using a 2-0. I use a bigger suture, 0 or number 1, because I have had some 2-0 snap. The diaphragm's really, really under a lot of pressure from the abdomen. So I think a big cough can generate a lot of pressure. It can snap stitches, even with pledgets. So I would encourage you to use the biggest stitch you can find in your box that you can get down a tube if you're using minimally invasive surgery. But if you're using uniportal, then you know the needle size isn't a problem. So our final video is actually a video profile, and we've put together a list of the 10 most popular articles in April. So we listed them in order of popularity, and right at the top there was trends and outcomes of cardiac surgery after TAVR. because as this tells you, TAVR, surgery after TAVR is now the fastest growing operation in the US and around the world. Vince Gaudiani's done a wonderful series of how to address this. We've done a few other videos of other people doing TAVR removal, using a purse string stitch to pull it together, and a few other tips. So, you know, it's a fast moving field, how you deal with these difficult cases. That was a really nice, that was my favorite actually as well. The other favorite for CABG was Tristan Yan's wonderful series of anaortic off-pump CABG, really relaxed how to do a wonderful off-pump operation. Just makes you want to do it his way when you see his videos. We did an interesting story about the labeling recall for the impeller pump. So if you missed that, check that out. We did some Hokum videos. We profiled some of the Red Residents video competition winners. And that was one of the Hokum ones. And we did a really nice Ross procedure webinar by Karim Badir and Peter Plucht. I really enjoyed that. So check that out. And of course, one of my highlights was that it was really popular. Some of our April published World's Best Series from the Cleveland Clinic. And in April, we profiled Faisal Bakin's wonderful CABG and a few other of those videos. So that was the top 10 of CTSNet. If you're chilling out, wondering what you've missed in April. And that's all our content for this week. Upcoming events, well, none other than the ESTS. I'll be there in Barcelona, May 26th to 28th, world's biggest thoracic lung surgery only conference. So I'm really looking forward to that. EACTS has got a case corner. It's virtual online, May the 30th, just 10 euros to register, and you can sit at home and watch that. And there is a World Summit for Pediatric and Congenital Heart Surgery on June the 5th to June the 9th in Bologna, Italy. And that brings us to the end of this podcast. I should just check in with Diego, the roving thoracic surgeon. Where is he this week? Well, this week he opened a training center in Langzhou in northwest China. 100 surgeons, including people from all over the world, and they did training to those 100 surgeons on intuitive robotic uniportal surgery. They did intuitive ion bronchoscope surgery training and VATS, of course. So setting up a huge number of training centers out there in China. Well done, Diego. And I'll be meeting you as well in a month's time in Ghana. So thank you very much for watching to the end, my CTSNet friends. I will be here next week, and I hope you can join me too for another edition of the CTSNet Beat podcast.